This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Just because your money's offshore doesn't mean it's dirty, you know. Shell companies for both good and evil. On the program today from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, April the 4th is what my calendar says. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. If you are in the tippy-top sliver of the global socioeconomic elite, whether business person, politician, or other, today is turning out to be a potentially uncomfortable day for you. All of us have spent most of the past 24 hours or so reading about the Panama Papers, leaked documents from a Panamanian law firm that are raising questions about rich and powerful people using offshore companies and accounts to, well, how best to put it? Oh, yeah, to hide their money. The firm in question, Mossack Fonseca is its name, specializes in setting up these kinds of shell companies. And while they're often mentioned, these companies, in the same breath as money laundering and tax evasion, shell companies can be on the up and up as well. Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going.
A shell company doesn't give you a lot to look at, explains Scott Dyring, accounting professor at Duke's Business School.
A shell company is basically a company which doesn't contain a lot of assets or operations.
And it often contains none of either. Shell companies can be shadowy, but not good or evil on their own. They can help hide income and evade taxes, or much worse. But shell companies can also help regular companies do lawful business, explains University of Utah law professor Shima Boffman.
There's a ton of legal purposes for using a shell company. For instance, with mergers and acquisitions, a lot of real estate transactions.
One famous example gave humanity Walt Disney World. Disney formed a bunch of shell companies to buy up land. If it had been as Disney, prices would have gone sky high. So shell companies were good for Disney and those who like Space Mountain and giant turkey legs. But they were bad for those who sold to Disney on the cheap. Also, shell companies can sometimes make it easier to raise capital or expand operations. Again, Duke's Scott Dyring.
Overseas, for example, you may need different types of organizations depending on the structure of your business.
Tech firms like to use shell companies to camouflage their next move. And of course, companies use them to reduce tax burdens in ways that are legal, though extremely controversial.
It's incredibly easy and cheap to form shell companies.
Gabriel Zuckman is a Berkeley economics professor who studies how shell companies can be abused. And when you think of shell companies, good or bad, don't just picture some obscure tropical country. Plenty of shell companies are formed right here in America. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
About four or five long blocks west of where I am right now in Manhattan, there is a billboard-sized sign with a real-time running tally of the U.S. national debt, $19.2 trillion at the moment and ticking higher almost as fast as the human eye can process. I mention it because this weekend, Republican frontrunner Donald Trump told the Washington Post that he would eliminate that debt, all $19 trillion of it, in 8 years as president. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore did a little calling around to see how that might go.
Trump's plan produced some strong feelings among economists.
That's just nuts.
It's absurd. It's crazy. It's also impossible.
That's Ken Rogoff at Harvard and Justin Wolfers at the University of Michigan. Someday I'll ask them how they really feel. Glenn Kessler is fact checker for The Washington Post. He says Trump isn't accounting for the additional debt that's projected to accumulate over the next 8 years. That would bring the total to $26 trillion, not $19.
The fact of the matter is there's just not much you can cut.
The bulk of the federal budget pays for Medicare, Social Security, and entitlements, which Trump has promised not to cut. The rest is discretionary spending for the military, education, highways, everything else, which over 8 years only adds up to $10 trillion.
So if Trump eliminated every government function except for, you know, paying out the Social Security bills and the Medicare bills, it wouldn't get him very far. He'd still have $16 trillion worth of debt to eliminate.
The Trump campaign has said it would sell off government assets, land, buildings. That totals only about $3 trillion, leaving $13 trillion left to cut. The necessary cuts to discretionary spending, says Justin Wolfers.
It would cause the U.S. economy to crash, not slow, not a recession, a depression.
A depression which would leave the world without its last functioning engine of economic growth, i.e. the U.S. economy. A sputtering economy would also reduce government tax revenue, which would make it even harder to reduce the debt.
The economy is not in a position to handle thinking about bringing down debt at the moment.
Harvard's Ken Rogoff. The Trump campaign suggested selling oil from government lands could generate offsetting revenue. The U.S. would have to sell as much oil per year as Saudi Arabia does for 100 years. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more down than up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The new law in North Carolina that changes the way cities and counties there are allowed to treat LGBT people is controversial, and that's putting it mildly. It's known as HB2, the law is, and corporate America is making its voice heard. Bank of America and American Airlines say that law will eventually make it difficult to lure top talent to their operations in North Carolina. But organizers of the biggest business event in the entire state say they might take a hit in just a couple of weeks when a trade show that is basically the fashion week of the furniture industry is set to kick off. From WUNC, Jorge Valencia has the story.
For a long time, North Carolina was at the center of furniture manufacturing. So it made sense that in 1909, the Southern Furniture Exposition opened here. They now call it the High Point Market, and it has an annual estimated economic impact of more than $5 billion. But organizers say that this spring, dozens of visitors are telling them they're not coming.
Addendum Gallery.
I called one of those guests.
This is Shane.
Shane Hardke owns a furniture store in the suburbs of Indianapolis. He's been in business for 13 years. And for the last seven, he's been traveling to High Point.
For a lot of the lines, it's the only place that they do show. I mean, so if you don't go there, you don't get to buy or you don't get to see the lines.
He says he also buys in New York and Atlanta, but that High Point is the best place for luxury carpeting and furniture. He says that last year, he invested more than $150,000 there.
So why aren't you going to go?
Because I don't want to support a state and a government that has sanctioned discrimination into their state law. Why would I want to do that? Especially in this industry that, you know, caters to a lot of LGBT people.
First of all, I'm not sure that accurate information about the bill is out there.
This is Republican Senate Leader Phil Berger, arguably the most powerful member of the North Carolina General Assembly.
Let's not fool ourselves at this point. The legislation that passed actually creates stronger anti-discrimination laws in North Carolina than have ever existed.
Berger and other Republicans say the law is an improvement because it creates a uniform standard across the state. That uniform standard does not include LGBT people as a class protected from discrimination. It also prohibits cities or counties from making them a protected class.
Businesses that I've heard from have indicated that they are receiving pressure from some of these far-left groups and that they would prefer to be involved in running their businesses as opposed to getting involved in this sort of thing.
So then the question is how out-of-state people's feelings about a law such as HB2 might affect an event such as High Point Market. Michael Hicks is an economics professor at Ball State University in Indiana. He saw similar business reactions in his home state last year after the governor signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Businesses pushed back, and legislators eventually scaled back the law.
But at the end of the day, 2015 ended up being a stellar year for Indiana, best year for visitation and tourism conventions ever. So very difficult to see any impact at this point.
Shane Hartke, who owns that store near Indianapolis, thinks that North Carolina will eventually roll back its law, just like Indiana did last year. Then he'll return to High Point Market.
Only if and when that happens.
Yes.
What if it doesn't?
Trust me, it will.
When reporters contacted the office of Senate Leader Phil Berger and asked if he was reconsidering HB2, they got a short answer. No. I'm Jorge Valencia for Marketplace.
If you're an internet user of a certain age, this...
You've got mail.
...will likely trigger some very real memories. The digital screech of a dial-up modem, a pile of discs, perhaps. Promise against 1,000 free hours of internet access. Maybe even the first time you dared enter something called a chat room. Those memories come, of course, courtesy of America Online, the internet company of the Web 1.0 era. Steve Case co-founded AOL in 1985. He's the former CEO and chairman of the board of that company, a tenure that included the disastrous merger with Time Warner. He's since become a venture capitalist, a philanthropist, and now an author. His book is called, with all deference paid in the text to Alvin Toffler, The Third Wave, an Entrepreneur's Vision of the Future. Steve Case, it's good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Are you a business guy or are you a tech guy?
Well, I guess a little bit of each. We co-founded AOL in 1985. It was the early days of the internet. Only 3% of people were online then, and they only were online 1 hour a week. So I had to understand some aspects of tech, obviously, to try to make the internet part of everyday life. But I think of myself as broader than that, more of a business person, kind of an entrepreneur, and an advocate for entrepreneurs and just trying to be their champion.
Probably the second line in your obit, right? Line number one is going to be Steve Case, founder of AOL, died today at the age of 97. The second line is going to be Case presided over one of the worst mergers in American business history, AOL Time Warner. You all right with that?
Well, hopefully that'll be like the fourth or fifth line. Up the second line is author of the best-selling book, The Third Wave, An Entrepreneur's Manifesto. But no, I understand that. Yeah, when we did the merger now 15, 16 years ago, it did make sense for AOL. We had been the best-performing stock of the decade. We were the first internet company to go public, and I recognized that it didn't work. I have a whole chapter in the book talking about why it didn't work.
Best, that's me, the best chapter, man.
One of the key lessons was about people and culture. That it's not just about the idea; it's about the execution of the idea. And we didn't have the right people focused on the right priorities, working together collaboratively in the right kind of way. And what could have been a great transformative company ended up struggling.
There's another legacy Silicon Valley company that's in some trouble now. Yahoo is putting itself up for sale, chopping up its parts. You have been hailed in PC Magazine as the guy who could fix Yahoo. You tried to buy the company back in the 90s from David Filo and Jerry Yang. Do you think Yahoo can be saved today?
I have not looked at in any detail recently, but I think they have a lot of valuable brands and valuable assets. So my guess is there is a way to kind of reposition the company and take it to the next level. It's hard, particularly in the technology world, it's hard. But we saw this with Steve Jobs when he went back into Apple. Yeah. I remember when he called me now, must have been 20 years ago, and said, I'm going back into Apple. Most people had given Apple up for dead. It had 2% market share. A market cap had dropped to a few hundred million dollars, and it was running out of cash. But because he focused on assembling the right team, the people, he focused on the right products in terms of innovation, he was able to take a company that many had given up for dead and create one of the most valuable, most impactful technology companies in the world. So it's certainly possible, but it requires a different mindset, a different mentality. And that's, I think, we'll see more of that, not just with companies trying to be repositioned going forward, but also the companies really trying to be the innovators in the third wave.
Which is, in some way, what this book is about, right? It's about this, not the actual third wave, as Alvin Toffler said, but your version of it, where we go from here in the internet.
I think there's going to be enormous innovation in the third wave because it's going to require more partnerships, more strategic partnerships, more engagement with government on policy.
Well, so about that whole government thing, I was surprised, honestly, to read in this book how strongly you favor government having a role in the tech industry and in the internet and in that kind of innovation in general.
Well, I'm not sure I'd necessarily say a favorite. I just think it's the reality of trying to disrupt these sectors because some of these sectors like healthcare are regulated by the government, will continue to be regulated by the government. So I recognize entrepreneurs don't like to hear that the government's going to play more of a role in the third wave, but I think that is the reality. The first wave really was about technology risk. Can you build it? The second wave was about market risk. Can you get people to adopt it? The third wave is going to be about policy risk and to some extent partner risk. Can you figure out the right way to get the right partners, including the government, involved to really take your idea and really make it happen?
You know him best from AOL. He runs Revolution, and he's also the chairman of the Case Foundation. Steve Case, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Head to our website. You can read an excerpt from Steve Case's book. It is, of course, marketplace.org. Coming up.
You know, when you sit down to a play, a new play by a writer you don't know, there's a little bit of like, you know, buckle up.
Private equity and dry powder straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 55 points today, 5 points, 0.3%, closed at 17,737. The NASDAQ off 22 points, 0.4%, finished at 4,891. The S&P 500 slipped 6 points lower, 0.3%, 2,066. Richard Branson says he couldn't do much to stop Alaska Airlines' bid to buy Virgin America. Alaska descended 0.3% on the news of that $2.6 billion deal. Virgin America soared 41%. JetBlue, which also had eyes for Virgin America, was off 0.4% today. Warner Brothers' Batman vs. Superman's first weekend box office leapt that proverbial tall building, but the second weekend, Kryptonite baby, down 68%. Time Warner climbed, though, today, 0.7%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. 191 migrants who had set their sights on a new life in Europe arrived today in Turkey. It's the first group of people expelled from the European Union under a deal made last month between the EU, which wants to do something about the flood of refugees arriving there, and Turkey, which is getting billions of dollars for taking in the people that Europe is kicking out. In this case, people who didn't apply for asylum or had their applications rejected. The BBC's Mark Lowen was in the Turkish town of Dikili as the boats arrived.
The main square of Dikili is, like most Turkish towns, called Atatürk Square. In the centre, a statue of modern Turkey's founding father proudly riding his horse and pointing towards the sea. That's where the first batch of migrants will arrive today from the Greek island of Lesbos, just across the Aegean. But in Dikili, there's significant opposition to the plan. Here on the square, there's a table where people are signing petitions against a refugee camp here. I've come to the table now. There are a few guys around here now writing. They say they don't want refugees. Nereye gidiyor?
İzmir.
So they're telling me that the petition goes to İzmir, the main city. It's being sent to the local governors. Why did you sign the document today?
Dikili is a very small town and we can't handle any more people. The way they live is different from us and they would be more comfortable in other refugee camps.
We can't accept them even though we pity them. We want to care for them, but they should go somewhere else, out of sight, where they can be at ease.
But as ever in Turkey, opinions are divided. Across the square, I meet Esin Ulur, who lives in London, but still has a house here in Dikili.
They shouldn't be banning coming here because they are homeless now. We should be supporting them.
Would you support a refugee camp here?
Yeah, why not? Yeah. I don't mind giving my house. If they need a house, I've got a summer house here. I believe that people are a bit selfish, okay? They are just thinking about tourism, their self. That's why I think we need to support them.
Beside the port of Dikili, a couple of tents have gone up to register the first migrants who will arrive. But after that, where will they go? Well, there's talk that the non-Syrians will go to deportation centres and the Syrians will go to the refugee camps on Turkey's southern border. There's been a mad rush to meet today's deadline, and still there are major concerns over whether this deal will hold, whether it's viable, or whether it'll actually stop the migrants from attempting the desperate trip across the sea in the hope of a new life.
The BBC's Mark Lowen in Dikili, Turkey, for us. So I'm back in New York today, had some more people to talk to. But when I was here at the end of last week, though, I had a chance to go see a new play. It's called Dry Powder, about a private equity firm that's in the middle of a PR nightmare at the same time that it's trying to figure out whether to buy a struggling American company and strip it down for parts and profit or to rebuild the thing and make a go of it. It's that push and pull between making as much money as you can or taking slightly less so people can keep their jobs. Claire Danes, John Krasinski, Hank Azaria is in it too. Quite the cast. All the more impressive when you consider it's the first actual production of one of her plays for the playwright Sarah Burgess. Dry Powder's at the Public Theater here in New York. Also the original home of Hamilton, by the way. Anyway, last Friday, Sarah Burgess swung by our New York bureau for a chat, which I started by asking her where she got the idea for this story in the first place.
I think it was when Mitt Romney ran for president. He billed himself as someone who had turned companies around, and there was sort of a metaphor there as far as, like, you know, turning America around and sort of being good at sort of restructuring an organization, right, and improving it. I remember reading a Times article about Bain Capital's buyout of a medical company called Data International, and it sort of focused a lot on the employees and the effect of layoffs and sort of how Bain Capital still ended up sort of extracting some money from the company and ended up okay, even though the company did go through a period of bankruptcy. So I found that intriguing and inherently a little dramatic. And at some point, it suggested two characters to me that I thought could be maybe kind of funny.
Which you see in the script and in the show that I saw last night. And eventually it makes its way to the public theater. Yeah. How did that happen?
I applied to the public's writing group, the Emerging Writers Group, and I had an agent. And the Emerging Writers Group has a policy that if you have an agent, you can't be in the group because they want to, you know, I think, admirably pull people in who really are outside of the industry.
And if you've got an agent, you in theory have a leg up. Right?
Totally fair. So I was not able to join the group. But I think in that process of applying, the play got passed through the literary department up to Oscar Eustace, who runs the public theater. Right. And then I got a call. My agent said, you know, Oscar Eustace wants to meet with you. And she was like, you know, just so you know, he meets with a lot of emerging artists. So this doesn't mean he wants to do your play.
Right.
But then, you know, now we're
doing it. And yet, and I'm holding the playbill from last night with a note in it that says, from Oscar Eustace, that says, it's rare, very rare, that I read a play handed to me by my literary department and immediately announce, we're producing this. But that's what happened with Dry Powder.
Yeah.
So it kind of worked out for you.
Yeah, it did. I'm still sort of shocked by that happened.
She says 6 weeks into this play's run.
Yeah.
To great reviews and a full house last night. And I'm sure full houses for the past month and a half.
Well, yeah. And I mean, to work with Tommy Cahill has been incredible. And
yeah, the guy who did Hamilton.
Yeah.
Just to drop the name here.
Yes, to drop the name. Yes. Yeah.
Right. I kept up with a lot of the lingo and a lot of the snappy sort of financy dialogue because I do this day in and day out. Did you worry about losing people?
I didn't at first because I was writing the play just on my own. Like, let me see if I can write this. But in the process of going before audiences, there would be times when you feel like even IPO, which is a term that I assume is kind of familiar to like the lay population, it's actually not. So that was a line that I changed.
Initial public offering, by the way, for those.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, well, right?
Yeah,
see,
exactly.
There you go.
But then even that phrase is not necessarily more clear for people. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's the thing. The LP, limited partner, you end up the same way. You know, when you sit down to a play, a new play by a writer you don't know, there's a little bit of like, you know, buckle up. Like, what am I in for? You know, and so then you hear people are like slammed with all these terms. I did actually start to sort of pare some of that down and try to give people a little way in, you know, in the dialogue. I don't know. I still don't know that I've attained mastery over writing that way, but I think it's a fun thing to at least try.
Yeah.
You just don't want to alienate people.
What's it like to read a review of your play in the New York Times? Where I think it was Ben Brantley, right?
It was Charles Isherwood.
Charles Isherwood.
Yeah.
He liked it. It was good. He said nice things about you.
Yeah.
What's
that
like?
It was surreal. You know, it's obviously a little nerve-wracking, but it's also everything you work for is one day to be evaluated, you know, at that level.
It bears a mention here that I think the first or second line in that review is, Bernie Sanders fans, have we got a play for you? I mean, it comes with an outlook, this play does.
It's funny. I never really thought of that. To me, like, it's a comedy, so the characters sort of are pushed to certain extremes.
That's so funny. You think it's comedy? I mean, it was fun. Sorry, wait. That sounded terrible. Because it was funny.
I
laughed a lot.
I heard it was a quiet house last night, but I didn't realize it was that quiet.
So I'm really sorry. It was funny, and there were a lot of laugh lines. But it's
– yeah.
I don't know if it's a ha-ha comedy, right?
Well, because there's a question of sort of people's livelihoods in the balance.
And there are value judgments made, and there are moral stands made.
I think to me that the play is about, you know, you have John's character and Claire's character, Seth and Jenny, arguing in front of their boss about what should we do with this company.
Right.
And so you have these two points of view presented. One is faith in free enterprise, and you pursue your own self-interest. And this is a really central value of this country. And the counter-argument is that John's character starts to offer has to do with maybe a little bit of restraint if it means that folks who are not well-positioned can keep their jobs. And, of course, I'm some, you know, liberal tote bag carrying, you know, Times reading person from Brooklyn, but I do see there's something about Claire's character and the honesty, you know, the lack of cant that I find, I do see the appeal of that. So I understand why the play could feel political in that way, but I didn't For me, it was about the tension between these two sides. Right. And mostly, I think it's funny when people fight with each other. So, like, hearing that fight, or I guess maybe less funny in your opinion.
No,
like,
no, it was funny. I laughed. It really
hearing
was.
That, hearing just... that, I'm just kidding. But, like, here, you know, so I think the play also interacts with our current political moment in that way, yeah. Which is obviously great in a lot of ways to have a play do that. But, yeah.
If you happen to be in New York through the end of the month, it's at the Public Theater. It's called Dry Powder. Sarah Burgess wrote it. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
Okay, so first of all, it was funny. I feel really bad about that, but it was a funny play. All right, anyway, this final note on the way out today. I just want to take a quick second and run through the Tesla numbers from late last week and the weekend. Elon Musk's electric car company unveiled its consumer model the other day, the Tesla 3, as you might have heard. $30,000 or so dollars is the sticker price. 275,000 people put down deposits of $1,000 cash so they could get one. You do the math, that is $275 million that Tesla just got. No interest due, no payments to make, no nothing, no equity liquidation, no nothing. Money just landed in their lap. Kind of brilliant, yes? Of course, now he just does have to build the thing, right? Oh, look at the time. We got to go. The Dow off 55 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ off 22 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 down 6 points. 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. See you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.